Good afternoon. So, last time we talked about exceptions, and this is sort of a way for the hardware to run the operating system. So at boot, the OS sets up this table of exception handlers, we call the exception table. The hardware will jump to an exception handler when it wants the OS to handle some kind of event. It runs that in kernel mode. This is the primary way we switch from user to kernel mode and vice versa. We switch from user to kernel mode when an exception happens and we want to run the exception handler. And if an exception handler returns, it can go back to user mode. And we learned that the system calls we learned about earlier are a type of these exceptions. So this mechanism we use for system calls for when the program requests something, have the OS do something, we reuse that same sort of hardware machinery not only to handle requests from the program, but also to handle other types of events. We mentioned we had external events like key presses or data coming in off the network that we want the OS to handle. Or timers going off. When we said programs were running for too long, we wanted to stop them. And it's also used for cases where programs do something weird, like if a program tries to access memory that isn't assigned to it, or tries to divide by zero. We're going to have the hardware ask the OS for help. The hardware doesn't know what to do next. So it will run the OS using, again, this same mechanism. We mentioned one thing kind of implemented taking advantage of exceptions is this idea of time multiplexing, that we can divide up the time that each program gets use of the processor. And we can do this in a way where it's kind of invisible to the program. The program is written kind of the same way it would be written as if it had exclusive control over the processor, but it, of course, doesn't. So to implement this, we have exceptions occur and run the OS instead of the program. And these exceptions are going to be responsible for saving what the program was doing for later and restoring some other thing that now is getting time on the processor. And we can call this idea time multiplexing. And from the program's point of view, we have something that's kind of like a dedicated processor, because like they're writing it like a dedicated processor, but it's not really a dedicated processor. We call this abstraction a thread. And we're going to talk more about programming with threads much later in the semester. But this idea of this kind of fake processor, you know, you program as if it's one processor, but it's really implemented, you know, by sharing fewer physical processors than we have threads, that's this thread idea. So questions on exceptions and time multiplexing? Yes? Sorry?
Is memory an I/O device?
Is memory an I/O device? Not generally for the purpose of this class. Maybe a point of confusion here is that often the way we access I/O devices, which we might mention later in the semester, is going to be through the same wires the processor might use to access the memory. In many systems, that's how that things work. Is that? Question, do we need system calls to access memory? No, so the way I think about it is that we have, you know, we have our hardware interface, and we kind of have these like two versions of it. So we have the privileged operation version of it. So we have the kernel mode version of it and the user mode version of it. And the only things that are going to be added to the kernel mode version of the hardware interface are going to be things like accessing I/O devices like keyboards and network cards, things that are generally shared between programs. So it wouldn't be safe to let any program deal things with it, and like manipulating other programs' information. So we have this kernel interface, and that's what the OS gets to use, and normal programs use this user mode interface, but that user mode interface is going to let you do all the things you've done in assembly. So like, you know, all the code, you know, sort of all your calculation code can run on the user mode version of the interface. Calculations, accessing memory, that all works entirely in user mode. It doesn't need the OS to get involved. And that's good, because if it did, that would be much slower. We'd have to run extra code just to get a number from memory. That would make our system too slow. But it's okay if we have to run extra code to display something to the screen, because we don't do that nearly as often, because, well, if multiple programs want to display something to the screen, we need some code to decide who goes first. How do we coordinate that? Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Yeah. So the question is, if I have a program with multiple threads, a process with multiple threads, is it context switching when it switches between those threads?
Yeah, like a single program A and just have multiple threads for it.
Okay, so let's talk about context switches, since I have a separate line on that. So context switches are what we call when the OS saves the state of one thread and restores the state of another. So we're saving register values for some later use to potentially switch back. Maybe we won't actually switch back. Maybe the program will ask for input and then we'll kill it. But we store the values to potentially maybe switch back later. And then we restore some values from something else we saved earlier or set up earlier. So that's a context switch. So as you alluded to, sometimes if we have processes which have multiple threads, which is something we'll talk about later in the semester, we can have a context switch where we change between two different threads of the same process. And in that case, we're not going to change what memory is accessible, and the two threads might be using the same global variables. But that's still going to be a context switch because we're changing out all the registers. So RAX, RSP, all those values are going to be swapped out to switch from one thread to another, because each thread looks like its own CPU. It has all its own registers. That's the big thing we're coding on the CPU. And sometimes we'll also have context switches between two different processes, where in addition to changing those basic registers, we'll also change that mapping from the addresses the program uses to the real addresses, because the programs have independent ideas of what's in memory. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yes, back there.
So where are the register values saved? Are they typically saved on stack?
Question, where are register values saved? So that's up to the operating system, because the operating system is writing the code to put the register values somewhere so they can get them later. Generally, I guess most commonly, that's going to be somewhere in memory that's exclusive to the OS, though it doesn't have to be. Just because OS code is running to do it, and we want to retrieve those values when we're running a different process to do that part of the context switch. If you take a more advanced OS course, you'll learn that OSs often have a separate stack for each thread. That's probably the most common OS design, in which case that stack might be where things are saved, but that's not the only OS design that's possible. So not necessarily on a stack. And usually we won't save it on the stack that you were using. And if you want to think of a reason why, you might say, of course you can push things on my stack, but let's say we had some code that was kind of buggy and accessed things beyond the end of the stack. If we saved things there on a context switch, then your code would kind of manifest its bugs when we were switching to other programs and not otherwise. And that would be really weird. That would be really hard to debug. So usually we avoid such scenarios by kind of completely hiding the context switch from the program by not storing any of the information in stuff the program would potentially normally access. Just so it's, there's no way you're going to know, besides looking at timing, that you weren't actually on the processor the whole time. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, So we talked about context switch, and we mentioned that processes can have one or more threads, and this idea of an address space, which is that illusion of kind of a memory that's independent of any other program. We mentioned that was going to be implemented, as we'll discuss a lot as our kind of next big topic, by having the OS set this mapping from the addresses the program uses, so any of the pointers you use in assembly code you write are going to be turned into some other values based on something set up by the OS. And because these are different for two different programs, you can have different things that look like they're at the same memory address. And we're going to move on to our main topic for today, which is signals, which are kind of like a version of exceptions for normal programs. And we'll look at some examples of how they work and what exactly I mean that they're kind of like exceptions for normal programs. So, other questions on things we covered last time? Yes, there.
Can I ask a question about the quiz?
Can we ask a question about the quiz? Sure.
So, on the last questions,
okay.
Why?
Question, yeah? Which one?
Why is the...
So there's one question about if there's a division by zero, what state are things in when the exception handler runs, and the other, which was about what happens if there is no division by zero, what things occur in kernel mode.
Okay,
so, yeah. So this is about what things occur in kernel mode, and are you asking about the last option, returning from printf? We'll talk about that, because that was the most common wrong answer. So returning from printf, people wanted that to be in kernel mode. So what I would say, so if you look at what printf is, so printf, basically it does some things, you know, it does like compute string and does a syscall to output, and then it returns. So there is a syscall in printf, and that syscall, yes, is going to cause code to run in kernel mode. But when we're actually returning from printf, we've done that syscall already, and we know that returning from printf shouldn't work this way because, well, you know, printf's just a normal function that happens to run some syscall operations in it. And most of the work printf does, in fact, it does a lot of work to like compute the string to output, like dealing with all the formatting stuff, like converting floating point numbers to strings and all that. So the actual returning part, you know, that this part here, this is user mode. Even though, yes, it probably happened shortly after we did something in kernel mode. Yes? What if we understood the question to be returned from the syscall? Question, printf is a wrapper for a system call. That is one of the things we were testing, is that the system call is a simpler operation than printf.
Yeah, I know, I get that. I'm saying, like, I read it as when you return from the printf system call.
You said, question, you read it when you return from the printf system call. So there is no printf system call. So if that's what you're understanding, that's not something I want to give credit for. If your understanding is, oh, the syscall was the last operation, maybe we'd think about it. But yes, one of the points I wanted to make is that system calls are often simpler operations than things libraries provide. Like, the OS is not going to bother implementing formatting strings for you, because that's something we can do perfectly fine in normal code. Yes, back there. Will we get partial credit for questions 2 and 3? Yes. People are going to have to like go through the answers and figure out what the partial credit is. Yes?
So, printf would be like the C library function, and then the system call would be like write or something, like for an output.
The question, printf would be the C library function, and the system call would be write? Yes, something like that. Now, the function called write that you might see in C code, that's also not the system call, it's just a function which calls it. Like, the actual system call, you know, one reason I know it's not like being returned from when we call printf is because, well, the way system calls are called is different than the way we call functions. And therefore, how the OS returns from a system call is different than how we return from a function. Yeah?
I had a question about the one about which of these steps require non-system
exceptions. Okay, so question two was asking about what things require non-system call exceptions.
And my question would be, when it's the OS between the different processes, wouldn't that require an exception because of context switch?
Question four, wouldn't step three? Question, would switching between different processes require a context switch and therefore an exception? Yes, but that exception could be a system call. So for example, though I don't see where you think there's one that's not. So here, this exception, so here either the switch is happening between these two operations, or if it's happening as the result of the first one, probably what's happening is you make a system call, you say, hey, I want to read from the keyboard. And the OS says, gosh, can't do that for you right now. Let me run something else. So the actual way the OS started running was the system call, and it decided to do a context switch based on that. There wasn't an additional exception to trigger the context switch. Does that answer your question? So the question is, you thought there was a timer that would trigger context switches. So context switches can be triggered by multiple events. So the most obvious one is that if I write a program that runs for too long, the OS switches away from it, and it uses that with the help of the timer you described. But there's other cases where we want to switch away from a program. So for example, if my program is waiting for a key press, there's no reason to keep running it. It doesn't really make sense to keep running it. So we're going to context switch away from it to run something else. And so that would be the most likely cause of switching away from A. Or at least is enough to know that we shouldn't assume it, but it must have been because of a timer going off. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. I think I'll just stop my office hours or something.
Okay. Other follow-ups back there. Question, to switch from processes, do you need a system call? You do not need a system call, but the OS needs to run somehow. So that could be from a system call, or it could be from some other kind of exception. So like the OS could decide to switch based on the timer going off we mentioned, which would cause an exception to make the OS run. You could decide to do it based on you pressing a key. But the OS needs some mechanism to start running. Does that answer your question? Yes. Do you need a system call to terminate a process? So if you're deliberately terminating your process, probably you're doing that with a system call. If you're accessing out of bounds memory, that's probably not a system call, because that's not like, you didn't like write code specifically to terminate your process. You broke code to access memory and it didn't work. So that will cause an exception, which could terminate your process, but it's not a system call. Does that answer your question? Yes.
Can you explain why A on question 4 is wrong?
Why is A on question 4 wrong? Because we haven't called printf yet. If you remember how functions are called, in assembly, we're going to do like call printf, but before that, we're going to set the arguments. We haven't done this yet. We haven't done the call yet, so the local variables aren't there. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
So when you have a system call that triggers a context switch, like getting input that isn't available yet, is it the actual system call that like has like code like if the input isn't available, then like switch, or does like before it like returns to the program, gives the OS like some time to figure out if it wants to switch to another program?
So the question is, when I make a system call that like asks for input, does that system call switch away? Or is there some other way that the program runs for a bit and then we switch?
Like, is there actual like code in the system call that allows for the switch, or does it handle all of the operating system and the operating system kind of figure out what to do?
So question, is there code in the system call that handles the switch, or does it hand it off to the operating system? So this is like not a meaningful distinction, because the system call implementation is part of the operating system. So handing it off to the OS would be the same as the system call implementation does it. And of course, the internal like design of the OS, you know, there might be like separate modules for handling these things or something. So it could vary a lot. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yeah.
So question four. Even if printf isn't called, wouldn't the local variables still be on the stack?
Question, even if printf isn't called, wouldn't the local variables still be on the stack? So the local variables for printf would not be on the stack in this case, because what we're saying is that we had to divide by zero when computing the arguments to printf. So this here is what failed. And if we think of how printf's called, we're going to first like set RSI based on that division, then we're going to call printf. So the instruction which failed must be somewhere before the call to printf. So we haven't allocated space or done anything to set those local variables yet. Is that? So the question, when we create a local variable, doesn't that get pushed to the stack automatically? So there might be assembly that places allocate space on the stack for it. Generally, for if it's a local variable of printf, that would be something that's done at the beginning of the printf function's assembly, which we haven't reached yet in this case. Does that answer your question? Back there. So the question, is the option which starts lookup.l colon lookup.c wrong because we're not supposed to be generating lookup.c?
The output of generate lookup.py.
Yeah, so there's three of them which write the output of lookup to write something to lookup.c. So you need to be more specific. But there's one which starts lookup.l colon lookup.c. And that says we can generate lookup.l from lookup.c. But then the rule overwrites lookup.c, which it says is a dependency. So that's what didn't make sense there, is that we're saying you need lookup.c first, but this is where the code to make lookup.c is. Does that answer your question? Yes, back there? Question for question four, we said the variable buffer, which exists before the call to printf, is on the stack. Is that being run before it puts in kernel mode? Yes. So if we think of the code C snippet, there's some code at like the top of this function, which is like allocate local variables for this function, and it would have been put on the stack there. Does that answer your question? Question, would integers x and y also be in the stack? The values of x and y would probably be on the stack or in registers. I would hope they'd be in registers because they should fit. The buffer probably doesn't fit in registers. Does that answer your question? Okay, over there.
So the local variables for printf, we're considering that to be like the arguments of printf and not like x and y, which is what I interpreted to be like the local variables used in printf.
Question, the local variables of printf, we're considering that to be the arguments, not the things used in it. So I would consider them things used in printf, which is why the answer was no, they aren't on the stack yet. We haven't started printf. Yes?
I was a bit confused about B because it's saying that the local variable buffer was stored on the stack. But isn't a local variable already on the stack? So why would it get stored on the stack again?
So question, why would it get stored on the stack? So the question is, wasn't the option saying that the exception handler stores it on the stack? That is not what I intended. I intended this to be a reflection of, you know, it's stored on the stack the same way a file is stored on my disk. Not that I'm doing that actively, but that is its state of being.
I thought it was then pushing it to the stack to save.
Yeah, so we might consider what to do about that. But yes, that was not the intended interpretation. The intended interpretation is that it was like stored just as a state of being, just like I have stuff stored on my phone right now. Yeah. Question, is the buffer variable referring to the memory location or the pointer? It's referring to the array.
Okay.
which is more than one memory location. Question, wouldn't the address be stored in a register? So you could do that, but most compilers won't because they compute it from the stack pointer. So if you like, if you take code like we saw in the question and like look at the assembly generated with some optimizations on, usually rather than like having a variable that stores the address of buffer, the compiler will just subtract the appropriate amount from the stack pointer when it needs to. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yes?
For this type of code on quizzes, should we assume that it gets compiled with O2 or something?
Question, for these types of code on quizzes, should we assume it gets compiled with O2? I don't think the answer changes to any of these, and that was my intention. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so one more thing here. Okay, so talk a bit about some anonymous feedback. So one thing is I mentioned at the end of last lecture that I didn't cover as much as I expected to. And I don't want to give the impression that my primary reaction to this is, let's go faster. So that's what's happening. For example, there were two topics that you may have noticed on the schedule that have disappeared. And we have some slack, but it's just that if I don't go as fast as I expect to, that can be fine. And I do want to be slowed down if I'm going too fast. So I have one piece of anonymous feedback saying I'm going too fast. In my experience, you know, there's a spectrum, and it's hard for me to tell where in the spectrum I am. Is it like 80% of the people think I'm going too fast? Is it like 20? But please, like, ask me questions, slow me down, so I don't do that. And, you know, especially if, like, you're trying to take notes and I'm going too fast, you can tell me, hey, can I look at this slide more? That's fine. Also, mentioning that our make lab, some people found hard to figure out if things worked. And the remark that in 2130 a lot of labs had expected outputs, and I would say that we should try hard to like give nice instructions on here's what we expect to happen. For the make lab, the problem is that there's a lot of correct answers with different outputs. So that's the main reason that didn't happen. I don't think there's like a systematic bias between having expected output or not, because most of the labs were written by Luther Chukanovich. So probably the difference there is that a lot of the labs we have just end up being a little open-ended. So that doesn't work out. Hopefully, for the cases where it does, we can make it obvious what we expect there. But for the make lab, there's a lot of valid make files which would do different things and therefore output different things and still be correct. Okay, so questions, feedback, or other things. Okay, so to our main topic for today. So, signals. So, last time we finished up, I mentioned we have this thing called signals, and these are an operating system feature on Unix-like OSs like Linux, that are kind of like exceptions for processes. So they can be triggered by other processes, they can be triggered by special events, and these are a lot of things where they're triggered by, well, things which trigger hardware exceptions, and basically what's happening is the operating system is forwarding a hardware exception to your program. So rather than the OS handling it, you can handle it. It's delegating the work to you. And these signals are a mechanism to do that. So, you know, their mechanism kind of delegate the hardware exceptions, and as far as how they're handled, it's very much like the operating system is doing the same kind of work the hardware does for the OS to your program. So the hardware like decides when to run an exception handler. For a signal handler, the OS decides when to run it and does the work of actually starting it. The hardware needs to save stuff before running an exception handler so we can go back. The OS is going to do the same thing when running one of these signal handlers. And on the hardware, when we run an exception handler, it changes what the processor is doing next. With signal handlers, it changes what your thread is doing next. So you said that thread is a virtual, kind of a fake CPU, but when a signal handler happens, just like if we had a real processor, we jump to somewhere else, your thread that was like previously in a loop now is going to be somewhere else, but it's going to be the same thread. It's going to be, you know, if we switch to that, your thread now it's in the signal handler, it's not in the thing that the signal handler interrupted. And that handler is going to run in user mode, not kernel mode, so that's a difference. And, well, that's because we run all your code in user mode. We never are going to run your non-OS code in kernel mode. Just never something we're going to do. We don't trust you. You could mess up shared resources. We're not going to allow it to happen. Some questions about kind of our high-level differences? Yes? Question, does it run in user mode because you always implement it yourself? Yes. So the signal mechanism is for you to handle these things. If you don't have handlers set up, the OS will have some default actions it can do on its own, like killing your program or doing nothing. But it will take some default action that doesn't involve running any code of yours, that is. Other questions? Yeah. Else? Yes. Question, would the default handler be running kernel mode or user mode? So in most implementations that I've seen, it's the default action happens in kernel mode. Whether, I don't think that has to be true. I think you could implement signal handlers in some hypothetical OS and not do that, but that's usually the implementation I see. Can I give a real-world example of exception versus signal? So let's do an example of signals, and maybe that will make things, we can go from there. So I'll do our people, other questions? So I'll do my example of signals. So here I have a program that reads from standard in and prints out what it reads. And a typical way I might run this is I read some input and it prints read some input because that's what my printf does here. And I keep doing that and then I press Control C and the program gets terminated. And it turns out that what Control C does on Unix is trigger one of these signals. And if you don't have a handler set up for that signal, the default action is to terminate your program. But we can set up a handler. So rather than having our program terminate when we press Control C, we could have it not terminate. Because the OS, when a Control C happens, what it does is it doesn't just terminate our program, it sends this signal called SIG interrupt to our program and runs a handler for that, or if there is no handler, the default action is kill the program. So what we'll be able to do is we'll be able to add some code to the beginning of our main function, such that now when I press Control C, it's just going to output, oh, you press Control C, and keep going. And as far as like the relationship between exceptions and signals here, so there's like an exception which happens when key presses are available, and the OS handles that by talking to the keyboard. But sometimes it chooses to like let us know about that by returning that information from a system call. sometimes it chooses to forward it with this signal mechanism. Is that your question over there, or yes? Question. So we mentioned that segmentation faults trigger are an exception, and you're also learning, or we're about to get to, that they trigger signals. So you're ending one habit and getting another. So I'll do the same question with this control C example. So pressing control C triggers an exception. The keyboard telling the OS, hey, there's input for you to handle, and the OS's exception handler runs because that's what the hardware does. The hardware doesn't know about programs. And that exception handler decides, oh, this is a control C, let me forward it to the program if I've set up a handler. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah, and the segmentation fault case is going to be similar. The hardware informs the OS, hey, the program accessed something bad, and the OS decides what to do after that. And one of the things it could decide to do is use the signal mechanism we'll show an example of later. Answer your question? Other questions that I saw? Other hands? Okay. So let's look at what that code might look like. So here I've defined a normal function, which is going to be my signal handler. It has to take just the interface that the Unix provides, so that it has to take one argument, which is going to be the number of the signal. So every type of signal has a number. In this case, the number is going to be this constant called SIGINT. I don't actually bother checking it because I want to do the same thing regardless of what it is. And I write control C press to the screen without using printf. We'll talk about why I didn't use printf later, but I'm just writing control C press to the screen. And before that control C happens, I set this up by telling the OS, hey, this handle SIGINT function here, that function, that's the thing I want you to use if the SIGINT type of signal happens. And SIGINT is the one that corresponds to control C, which I looked up in the documentation. And now, whenever that happens, it will run that piece of code up there, and rather than just terminating my program, which was the default thing it would do for control C. Yeah. Do we need to include some headers for this? Yes. You can look those up. I'm gonna keep my slides cleaner by not having them there because you can look it up when you need it. Yes?
So you want to handle some other signal, you would just like substitute SIGINT for something else in the red line.
Question, if I want to handle a different signal, I could substitute SIGINT for something else? Yes. Question, does the second argument to SIG action always have to be a function pointer? It has to not be a function pointer. Here it is this struct SIG action, which I have filled in one field of with a pointer. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yes. The question, the operating system has a default handler for exception and interrupt stuff, and this is a way to override it with your own? I wouldn't put it that way. So this is what we're doing here doesn't change how exceptions and interrupts are handled. It's just going to be like an if statement in that OS exception or interrupt handler. It's going to be like, oh, if there's a signal handler, call it instead of moving on. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Yeah.
Signal. Do you need to, like, if you handle SIGINT, do you also need to handle, like, SIGSEV, or can you just do one specific?
Question is, do I have to handle all the signals, or can I just handle some of them? You can handle as few as you want. There's a default action for all the signals, which is usually either terminate your program, like default action for SIGINT, SIGSEV fault, and if you don't change that, still going to do that. Sometimes the default action is like do nothing, and if you don't change it, still going to do that. Yeah. So this is kind of similar to a catch block. You can think of it as like that, except that this kind of scope of when we're checking for control C is just after we call sig action, it's installed. It's not going to go away unless we call sig action again. Yeah. Question, what is the sig empty set? So that controls what signals can happen while our signal handler is running. For the most part, we can leave it as kind of this default value of don't change anything, which is what sig empty set is. Yes? What is the third argument to sig action, this null pointer? That is a, if you pass a non-null pointer there, you can retrieve the previous signal handler value. Yes.
What does SA restart do?
What does SA restart do? SA restart means that if our signal handler interrupts something like printing, something like a system call, try to restart the system call when it finishes rather than like failing that operation. So usually it's something you probably would want to set it, but if you turn it off, and your signal handler runs while doing something, that thing will just be stopped. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Where does the handle
where does it need to get called? So the OS is going to call it. I'm going to show in more detail how that happens, like what happens with the stack on a future slide. Okay. So as people have alluded to, there's a lot of signals. So here's like a selected list of different signals, and these are all constants in signal at H, which are just integers. So we have sigint, which is what control C does. We also have the possibly familiar sigbus and sigsegfault, which stand for bus error and segmentation fault, which are basically invalid memory accesses will turn into one of those usually. We have sigfpe, which is floating point exception, which bizarrely is what integer divide by zero turns into. Why is it called floating point exception? But that's what it turns into. And we have a few others. There's two I want to kind of note. I guess there's probably four I should note. So I should note this sig user one and user two. So we're going to do a lab on signals tomorrow. And we want to have signals kind of for our own use. And user one and user two, that's what they're for. They're for use by the user however they want. There's also two very special signals, sigkill and sigstop. So these are signals you can't set a handler for. They always will either kill your process for sigkill, terminating it immediately, or stop your process, like pausing it, like you might like a debugger might do. And you can't override that. Questions? If sigsegfault, your segmentation fault, if that's really a signal, we could set a handler for it. So let's do that. Here we are. Here's a program where I've set a handler for sigsegfault. So I just do the same thing, and I just print out, hey, I got a segfault. And then I have some code here to trigger a segfault by moving a value into an invalid memory location. So I run this program, and what's going to happen? Well, it runs the handler a lot. And what's happening here is it runs my handler, it returns, and it goes back to where it was. And where was it? It was at this move instruction. So we're going to do that again. And well, OK. And it's going to try again, and that's going to trigger a segfault. So we have a handler for that, though. So we're going to run that handler, and then we're going to go back. And we just keep doing that. Yes.
Is the ASM function, is that the same thing as inline assembly in C?
The question is the ASM function inline assembly? Yeah. So the ASM is inline assembly in my compiler. It's not actually a C feature. This is a like GCC or Clang feature. But it's not obviously not portable. Other questions? Okay, so that's signal handler. So some just the signal API. So we've looked at sort of the function for registering a handle for a signal, which is sig action. Another notable function that exists, you can look up like what the argument order is, in the man pages or similar. But for sending a signal to a specific process, there's a function called kill, so named because often we use this to terminate a process, but you don't have to. It just sends the signal you specify to the process. There's a function called pause, which puts a process to sleep until a signal gets delivered. So it's a way of waiting for someone to send you a signal explicitly. And there's a function called sigprocmask and also a similar one called pthreadsigmask. They both basically do the same thing, which are allow you to temporarily kind of block and unblock signals from being received. And when a signal is blocked in this way, the OS will remember that it's supposed to send it to you, but it won't send it until you unblock it. We'll talk about why that might be useful in a bit. In addition to this kill function, there's also a kill command, which basically runs the kill function. So you can use it to kill specific programs, and how that works is it sends sigterm, which means please terminate. And you can also send specific signals by like including their name on the command line. Questions? Okay. Can I answer the question about SA restart? Okay, so let's do a little exercise. I have two programs here that use signals. My question is, what output do we expect if I run these two things at the same time? And the one is PID 100,000 and the other is PID 2000. What output do I expect? Check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what happens. And just to note, we have this sort of outputs X, and this outputs Y, and it kind of does it in a, just a way of doing it without primitive. Okay, who would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A? Okay, B? C? D? E? Okay, F? G? H? No clue? Okay, a bunch of no clue. So I think the plurality answer was E, and I think that's, I would say that or B is my favorite answer. And what's going on here is that, well, we have this kill call here, so that's going to immediately run our signal handler. Fine. And that means that we're going to print out X here. And then we're going to send PID 2000 SIG user 1. But there's a problem. And the problem is that, well, where in execution is PID 2000? We have a couple of different cases. So one case is that it might be here. In which case, well, we sent a signal and it doesn't matter. Because there was no handler set up for it. So it's probably going to kill the program. And let's say, and if it's right here, well, it will print out Y. But the problem is, after it's right at the end of main, what's the next thing that's going to happen in the program? It's going to exit. It's going to finish. It's no longer going to be running. So there's nothing to send a signal to. So there's this very tight time window in which we might be able to have it print out Y. And if we miss that time window, there's no handler anymore, either because we didn't set it up yet or because the program exited. Questions and how I reasoned about it. Yes.
So for the 2000 to be able to print out Y, it has to be after it has finished main, but before it exits.
Question, for it to print out Y, it has to be after it finished main, before it exits. I would say after it had finished SIG action. Yeah, before it had exited, yes. Yeah.
What is PID?
Oh, good question. I should have probably expanded this. So PID stands for process ID. And it's just a unique number for each process on the system. And when we call kill, as you can see, it's how we identify which process we're referring to. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Question, if the 2001 finished before 1000 started, wouldn't it print out Y? No, because in order for this Y to be printed out, this handler has to run. But there's nothing in PID 2000's code that would ever cause a signal to happen. Does that answer your question? Yes, back there. Oh, okay, over there.
How do you find out what PID is?
How do I find out what PID is? So on the lab, we're going to have you use the function called getPID. If you're from your shell, there's a program called PS that can list PIDs. Other questions? Yes, over there. Does the PID have any influence on
how programs
are run? That is entirely up to the OS. Probably not. Whether the PID affects like the order things run. Okay. Yes. Question: why would X be printed before Y? So the only thing that triggers a signal handler here is this call. Things that run in main are going to run before, you know, we have to trigger the first signal for the signal handler run. So the first thing that can trigger a signal handler is this call to kill here. And that means that this signal handler runs first. Does that answer your question? Okay, yes.
So is the only way for Y to print, you said, is that it starts with the main but doesn't completely finish with the...
The question, the only way for Y print is that it started with the main but doesn't completely finish. I would say it's like this very small time window after SIG action and before it actually finishes exiting.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can a process send a signal to itself?
Can a process send a signal to itself? Absolutely. In fact, there's a shorthand for this. There's a function called raise specifically for doing that, which is just equivalent to kill with your own PID. Yes?
So what does sig action do exactly?
What does sig action do? Sig action tells the OS, if this signal is triggered, run this function in the future.
So it doesn't wait for the signal?
Squares question, so it doesn't wait for the signal? Yes. There are ways of doing that. They aren't sig action. Yeah?
Why don't you use
sig user 1? Because it's a signal I know won't be used by something else like control C. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so let's talk a little about sort of how signals work on Linux to like give more an idea of what's the OS actually doing. And let's say we have a signal, be handle a run while foo is running. What's going to happen is that the kernel is going to actually save to your stack what was happening in your program, and then save this return address for your signal handler function on top of that, and then it's going to jump to your signal handler. So it's going to set things up to call your signal handler, including setting up this return address to the special code called restore.rt. So your signal handler is going to run, and then it's going to return to this restore.rt function. So you have your sigint handler, and it returns and ends up in this restore.rt function. And what that is it's just going to make a system call, which is going to ask the OS to help out and please undo that saving of registers and go back to where we were. So that's how the implementation works on Linux. So it actually adds to the stack to create a new function call, jumps to your code, and has it return not to where you were, but to some cleanup code in the OS. Which runs a system call that goes back to the state before the signal handler started. So we can continue your program as it was. Okay, so questions? Yeah.
So on the slides you uploaded on the site, there's a version 2 of the
There's a version 2 of this exercise? Yes. So the question is, in this case, would it be X, Y? Yes. Other questions? Okay. So this is kind of giving more of an idea. Like, we're not going to like test you on this, but I think this like helps make it clearer, like, how does signals interact with the code I was previously running? Like they actually use the stack on top of the code that was previously running. So another thing about signals I'd like to talk about is why you should never write signal handlers. And even though, yes, we're having you do it on the lab tomorrow and a following homework, why in practice you often don't want to do it. And here I have some code which looks like it should work fine. I have a signal handler that I'm going to register with sig action that calls printf, and I have it called a malloc. And it turns out that bad things could happen, potentially, because I'm calling printf in my signal handler that might run while malloc is running. And that's really not intuitive. And we don't know how malloc works, but one common idea that malloc might have is that like it, you know, might just keep like a pointer to the next piece of memory to return and increment that. So that's my proposal here, is that we have this pointer to the next piece of memory to return, we increment it by the size, and that's like kind of our silly implementation malloc. Malloc's probably really more complicated than that, but that will work for this example. And let's say we're calling malloc, and our signal handler runs in the middle of this. And the problem is that we could have the signal handler happen while malloc is manipulating that kind of internal pointer. And then we call printf. And maybe printf needs to allocate a buffer, so it calls malloc. And it's manipulating the same pointer. And we're in big trouble, because now this kind of pointer has an inconsistent value. Because the person writing malloc kind of didn't write malloc to be called while it's being called. And probably most functions aren't written that way, because it's actually really annoying to write functions that can be called within themselves which have any sort of state. So that's pretty bad. And you might say, okay, maybe the OS is going to guarantee that it's not going to write the code for malloc like this. I'm sorry, they don't. Instead, they have this other way of kind of giving you these guarantees, in that there's the people who standardize Unix, POSIX, and also Linux, have this list of what they call async signal safe functions. So these are functions that they guarantee don't have this kind of problem, where it's okay if you're calling them while they might be called. Malloc is not on the list. Printf is not on the list. Fgets is not on the list. Pretty much everything you'd want to use is not on the list. It's unfortunate. Write is on the list. That's why all my examples used write. Write guaranteed to work properly, even if we're calling it while we're doing write. So this is kind of an unfortunate thing for the lab. We're kind of explicitly just saying, don't worry about this, even though, yes, it could hypothetically be an issue. But this is why in real code, it's actually really hard to write signal handlers that do something non-trivial and have them consistently work. So you might say, what are some strategies, well, first of all, questions on this sort of lack of safety, why we might have problems from this scenario? Yes? Question, I'm saying HandleSegit uses the same internal pointer. So I'm saying if malloc has an internal pointer and HandleSegit calls malloc, then we have code then we're still using the same internal pointer, but the problem is we have like two pieces of code which are kind of competing with each other using that same pointer. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So this is the kind of unfortunate thing about writing signal handlers that run at any time. So there's some other options we might have to avoid this issue besides being very careful about what functions we use in our signal handler. And one thing we can do is that we can block signals. So we can tell the operating system that some signals we want to be blocked, and in that case, rather than delivering the signal to us and running our signal handler, the signal will become pending. And a pending signal, it's going to be handled in the future, but we're not going to deliver, we're not going to run the signal handler until it's unblocked. So you can use this to like have code where the signal doesn't happen and then have it happen after that code to kind of avoid these conflicts. And this is actually very similar to something hardware provides operating systems. So just like we found it was very annoying to write, you know, it seems like it would be very annoying to write code that can be called in the middle of itself, like was happening to malloc in our example, it's also very annoying to write OS code, which can be interrupted at any time by other OS code. So to help out the OS, hardware provides this idea called disabling interrupts, where they'll temporarily, in a similar way, disable running exception handlers, just like blocking signals and disables running signal handlers, until the OS is ready. So there's a similar mechanism for signals to solve the same kind of problem, but it's really hard to write code where other parts of your code can start at any time. We can also take advantage of this sort of blocking idea to kind of explicitly handle signals at a very particular time. So one option is that there's something called SigWait, which rather than using a signal handler, you can say, I've blocked this signal earlier, make it stop being, tell me when it's pending, and when it is, just return. That's what SigWait. It waits for the signal to be pending, but never runs a signal handler. So that's an option for doing that. And there's also calls you can make to like explicitly unblock this signal I blocked earlier and handle it now. So that's as an option if you want to handle signals at a particular time. And this makes sense for things like control C. Probably doesn't make sense for like segfault. Like can't really delay handling the segfault, but we can delay handling things like control C or user one. So questions on this other sort of types of signal handling. Here I have an example of using sigwait, where rather than having a signal handler, I just wait for control C by saying, don't do anything for it, block the signal, so don't run the default hand, don't run the handler, don't do the termination, and then wait for it. And I, of course, write this code wrong because I didn't test it. Yeah. This is what I get for not testing code. Yes?
I'm so sorry. What is that first word before
null? First word before?
Null.
Before null? Set. The variable set. Sorry, the argument shouldn't be sigint. We have to specify a set of signals. And I should have looked at this slide more carefully when I was making it. And yeah, I think using these, you probably look up the syntax. I want to get across the big point is that, hey, we can wait for signals explicitly rather than using a signal handler if we want to. Other questions? Okay, so that's on signals. So as you may know from the schedule, we have a lab tomorrow, which is writing basically a local chat program that uses signals and shared memory. So we give you the code for setting up shared memory, so you can have two programs have the same memory available to them. So like the OS sets up the mapping and it points to the same place. And we'll use signals to notify, have one program notify the other when there's something to read and print out. Note that this has to work on one machine, and the two programs need to be run by the same user, because you aren't allowed to send signals to other people's programs. Otherwise, it'd be pretty bad if you could kill everyone else's programs, which this would allow you to do, so that's why you can't do it. We also have a homework. That's going to be our first individual homework. And the homework is to time a bunch of things. So you need to time how long a function call is, how long a system call is, how long it takes to start a signal handler, how long it takes to run a command in the shell and have it finish, and how long it takes to send a signal to a process and send it back. This is a new homework. I'm hoping the size is appropriate, especially. So it is a bunch of code, though you are kind of doing these things in the lab, so that hopefully makes that less to figure out. And it's reporting the timings, and this is probably not going to be auto-graded because I can't really like auto-grade, are you timing the right thing? I'm going to need to have some people look at things and like look at your numbers quickly and things like that. So questions about the lab or the homework? Okay. So in our last 5 minutes, I'm going to introduce our next topic, which is going to be about sort of permissions. So we kind of as a motivation, when I ask to say open a file, we're going to make a system call. And one of the things that system call is going to need to do is it's going to need to decide, am I allowed to access that file? I kind of mentioned that one of the motivations for having the separate kernel mode versus user mode was that, well, we want the OS to be able to enforce this, that even though the disk has everyone's files on it, that I can only access my files, not other people's files. So we're going to talk about sort of how the OS makes this decision. And to make this decision, the OS needs more information. Because if I just look at the system call arguments, that really doesn't tell me whether I'm allowed to open this, right? My arguments are, I want to open my file, read only. Is that okay? Well, it depends who's calling that, but that's not part of the arguments. Can't figure it out from that, whether it's me or someone else running that. And we also can't really figure it out based on where the code is. If this code is in Emacs, well, it's okay for Emacs running as me to do that. It's not okay for Emacs running as someone else to do that. So there has to be somewhere else, some other information the OS has where it can track, you know, both, you know, kind of whether this is allowed, and, you know, based on what the process is running and what we're requesting to do. So we're going to talk about what form that information takes. There's kind of going to be two parts to that. And one part is going to be sort of what we're going to, how we're going to like label what files can be accessed by what programs that are running. And the other part is going to be how we mark programs as running for particular people and what that means. And something that comes up in this is that we kind of have two separate decisions, and I want to explicitly separate them. So one decision is this thing we'll call authentication, which is verifying that, you know, I am myself, that is me. That decision is like when I type a password, that's the purpose of that is to verify it's me and not someone else. That's going to be separate and something we're mostly going to gloss over from authorization, which is given that you know it's me, what can I do? And we're going to mostly be talking about the second problem, which is authorization. That we're going to assume we've identified who's who, and the question is going to be, how do we track what things are for who and what each of them are allowed to do? So questions on sort of authentication versus authorization? So if we're not like verifying who's who, we still need to track who's who. And the primary mechanism for doing that is that we're going to have something we'll call user ID. So usually a number that is associated with every single process. And that's going to be set by some procedure that does the authentication thing. So the password thing, that's going to set these user IDs. And after the password thing, every process is going to have a user ID associated with it. And usually we think of those user IDs as representing like a person. They don't have to, but that's sort of usually the idea. And this user ID, that's what the OS is going to be looking at to decide, is that open call allowed or not? And on POSIX and Unix-like OSs, so POSIX is the Unix standard that Linux mostly follows, you can get the user ID, which is just an integer, with this call here, get EUID, E for effective. You might say, wait a moment, there are other UIDs? Yes, but they aren't the effective ones, so they don't matter for the check of what you're allowed to do. So this number, that's typically what the kernel, the core OS code is tracking. That's what the system call is checking. It's just checking this number versus the file. And you might say, wait a moment, but I had a name, right? I log in with a username, not a user ID. How does that work? And typically on at least Unix-like OSs, that is tracked entirely outside the kernel mode code. So all the stuff that handles system calls knows nothing about usernames. It just knows user IDs, but they're like the libraries and the programs that display things, they have a database mapping the IDs to names that they can show you. And that's where we'll finish up today. See you lab tomorrow. We'll talk more about sort of this authorization next time.